Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we're talking all things Spurs. How good are they? Does Ange Postecoglou need to change tactics? And who could they target to improve in January? Then we've got the burn book. While over on the paid side, we run through a bunch of your football questions, including why La Liga isn't good anymore, who we'd like to see give a totally honest football interview, and who's got a shot at breaking into the top six this season, before we take a look at your hot takes. That's all on this week's episode. So we're back for another two episodes. Pete Dorman, it's good to see you, Pete. How are you?
Hello. I'm fairly well. I'm okay. This morning was a morning where I woke up and you don't feel like you've got a sore throat, but you feel like it's the very, very early stages of a sore throat. It's not sore enough to feel, to say that it's sore, but it's like, there's a little something there. And I'm concerned about how that's going to progress and develop. Also, more concerned than usual because about 36 hours from now, I will be on a plane to Belfast for a stag do.
Not a great environment to be ill. Not just a
stag do, a 30-person stag do. Ooh. Which is a staggering amount of people for a stag do. Yeah, so it's really interested to see how the next few days progress because, yeah, like you say, that would be a horrible environment to have a cold in. Or generally not feel tip-top shape.
But possibly you can raise the alcohol level in your blood to such a point that it will kill anything that's lingering. Is that possible?
I reckon I'll give it a good college try. Mm-hmm. We'll work our way up to pure ethanol and see if that flushes everything out. It might just like reset my immune system.
Yeah. Why not start there?
Yeah. Well, start with ethanol and work our way back.
Yeah. Why not? Just go in hard, sort it out day one.
Yeah.
Bit of antifreeze and you'll be good.
Yeah. Lose sight in one of your eyes. It's fine. You've got two.
You have to. And your, how good are your eyes anyway, Pete?
My left, see this, is okay, so I've actually thought about this at length before, because I am a glasses wearer, I have long-sighted issues, and there's one eye that does all the heavy lifting, and one eye that's just there for the ride. It's basically just aesthetic at this point. So my right eye is like +3, which isn't good in the best times, but when you consider that my left eye is +6, the right eye starts to look pretty good. And because it's long-sighted, it's just things up close that are uncomfortable. So everyday life is completely normal. I play sport without glasses. I can do the little letter list, the letter board at the opticians that kind of you need to get to a sufficient point to be allowed to drive without glasses. I surpass that point every time. So like I'm legally allowed to drive without glasses. Always really reassuring when somebody says, I'm legally allowed to do this.
Yeah, that raises questions that you've technically already answered, but I don't trust it anymore.
But basically, the reason for that is because my right eye just does all of the work and my left eye is just like, cool bro, thanks for that. So if I were to lose my left eye, really wouldn't be much different.
You're basically like, it's like you've got a telescope to one eye at all times. and the other eye is kind of half closed, right?
Like my left eye is so long-sighted, I've always needed to go for like the most expensive, thinnest lenses that technology can provide at that point of time. In the 90s, it wasn't great. It's much, much better now. But like I've always had to go at the most expensive level of like thin lens technology because if I didn't, they would be literal like milk bottle bottoms. It would be so thick that like normal frames just couldn't contain it. So if I lost my left eye, not ideal, but not catastrophic. If I lost my right eye, I'm 80% certain that I would then potentially be classified as legally blind.
Oh, wowza.
Maybe. I'm not sure. Probably with glasses, it would just be like partially sighted. I guess you would be defined that anyway if you lose an eye. But
okay, so the ethanol is like, it's quite a high risk, high reward.
No, I just need to keep it in the left side of my mouth, right? And then that's how it works. Yeah. Then. Yeah,
maybe you drink it and then you just lie down on your left side, and it all just like settles on that side of your body.
Yeah, we'll lose one kidney on that side, but the left eye, that's fine.
We'll sacrifice the left kidney for the right.
But yeah, well how are things with you, Patrick? Outside of you know, drinking poison or encouraging me to drink poison.
I'm totally fine. I'm actually drinking, well, I'm obviously not drinking any poison today because honestly, I wasn't prepared enough. And I don't know if we have any margaritae left in the house at this stage. We probably do somewhere. But I'm all good, man. I'm all good. I'm on double baby duty tonight. So I've got, on my screen, I've got you, and then next to you, I've got another screen with each of my children on it.
So all three of your children?
Because Emma's out. Exactly, yeah, all three of my children. Yeah. The microplastics. As we've decided to term them. But yeah, I'm good, man. I've got nothing to report. Like, it's weirdly warm today in October in London, which I find like a sign of the end times. But I'm trying to get pumped to talk about Spurs because we put a call out for questions and we've never had such an insane response. I genuinely must have got 30, 40 responses. Like, I mean, actual proper questions that we could use and hot takes, which we will come onto on the paid side. And three of these questions were about Tottenham. So I thought, yeah, we've basically got to do it. So Ben Stevens wanted to know who Spurs could target in January and what we thought of Ange's tenure so far. Harry wanted us to talk about Ange generally and whether he needs to change the way he's playing. And Joshua Davis talked through some of Spurs' positive numbers, but he was asking whether Spurs are lacking some leadership on the field, what we thought the biggest issue at Tottenham was. He also signed off, "Stay toxic, fellas," with like the saluting emoji. And I thought, I think we may need to make that our sign off at the end of the show. Stay toxic.
Stay toxic.
So, okay. So shall we get into Spurs then? Because like Spurs are kind of confounding. They're in ninth after seven games. At the same time, like they've really blitzed some teams. So the Brentford win that I think was 3-1, if you watched that game, it was extremely one-sided after minute one, whenever they went behind. Yeah. And then the United game, obviously United end up getting a red card, ends up like 5.4 on XG to like 0.4, something nuts. But to be honest with you, even before the red card, it was incredibly one-sided. Like Spurs were kicking the shit out of United. But then they've lost to Brighton from a commanding lead. They've lost at home to Arsenal. They've lost to Newcastle. There's that draw with Leicester, which was also from a winning position. So you just kind of don't know what to make of them right now. I mean, do you want to talk through some of their numbers though? Because like, if you don't look at the expected goal tables or whatever, you might just look at them in ninth and be like, yeah, they've lost three games and like maybe they're not that good.
Yeah, I mean, the like you said, Joshua Davis's question kind of pointed out that there is quite a bit of a juxtaposition in Spurs' underlying numbers and their overall position. So just to dig into that very quickly, like if you look at Spurs' underlying numbers, they would indicate that they should be much, much higher up. Well, in one sense, they should indicate that they would be much, much higher up the table. So
yeah,
they are first for expected goals with 15. Second for expected goal difference per 90 and for expected goal difference. They're also the only English team and one of just six in Europe's top five that have an average of over two non-penalty expected goals per 90 so far this season. So that, on of straight top by numbers, that's hefty. If you go a little bit deeper than that, they've got the second most shots and shots on target in the league behind City. They've got the hardest press. They allow you under nine passive per defensive action. They've got the second most high turnovers per game. Again, all of these are behind City. So basically, if you look at all of their attacking numbers in the press and their press effectiveness, other than expected goals, they're basically second behind City. So on the face of it, they're not giving up a huge amount against. They're racking up a fair amount of XG. They're getting shots off. They're hitting the target. Their shots are also like completely acceptable quality. It's not 0.12 expected goals per shot, which is like slightly higher than the league average, but basically league average. So it's not like they're getting a ton of shots just because they're taking anything and everything from anywhere. Like these are genuine league standard quality shots. They're pressing hard, but while we've been critical of the quality of Spurs' press over the Ange's period, you know, at times it has been absolutely reckless. So far this season, it has been fairly effective in the sense that it has won the ball up high more than any other team bar City. They've also had the second highest average possession with over 60%, again behind City. So all of these kind of underlying numbers across the first seven games, which granted is a small sample size, these all point to a team that should be, theoretically, if everything played out as their expected performances should have, should be much higher up the table than ninth. However, if you adjust your view to like the schedule difficulty versus performance, Spurs, as per Opta, are basically kind of exactly where they were predicted to be. They were predicted to win three, draw one. Yeah, they were predicted to win three, draw one, lose three across their first seven games. There are basically three contradicting things there. One, they're completely underperforming their underlying numbers. Two, they're performing exactly as they're predicted. And three, they are a super unstable team in terms of consistent performances. So one week it'll be amazing like United. Another week it'll be an absolute catastrophic collapse like Brighton. So there's a load going on at Spurs, and there's a load of things you can take from their stats and their position. But ultimately, like, it is a bit of a weird situation with Spurs at the minute. What are your thoughts on them?
Well, this is the thing. Like, Spurs' underlying numbers are better than their position in the table. But I think that's broadly because the games they've won, they've been insanely dominant. So they beat Everton. It was like 2.6 to 0.65 on expected goals. Brentford, 3.9 to 0.9. United, 5.4 to 0.6. So those three games, they deserve to win, and they did win those games. But when you look at the games that they lost, I think it would be hard to say they didn't deserve to lose them. Like, that's the thing. So the wins are kind of skewing things quite a bit because the wins have been really, really heavy. But you look at Brighton and it's like 2xG to 1 in Brighton's favour. Arsenal, it's like dead level. Arsenal slightly ahead. So not dead level, but quite level. Newcastle, pretty level. Okay, so maybe they didn't deserve to lose that one. Leicester, pretty level. So maybe you're looking at these results and you say, okay, maybe they deserve one more point, like based on the performances match by match. Whereas if you just look at their underlying numbers, then yeah, you're like, well, their expected goal difference is so good. But we're still in the stage of the season where one or two really heavy wins or heavy defeats make a massive difference. So I'm not saying you take out the fact that they battered Brentford, battered United, but one game has the power to skew numbers hugely. So Arsenal, you know, before they played Leicester, had obviously gone down to 10 men twice. Those were against Brighton and United and City as well. So they're like bad games to go down to 10. And so their XG numbers, like, put them like average in the league. Then they absolutely battered Leicester on XG, and they're back up as one of the best sides in the division. So it's quite easy for like a small sample to be corrupted basically by one particular game. And if Tottenham keep absolutely smashing teams, and then, you know, like half the time, and then in the other half of games, they kind of can't control it and they get outplayed and they deservedly lose, we're going to get to the end of the season and look at their XG numbers and say, oh, well, those are a lot better than their position. But actually, when you watch them on the pitch, I don't think people are wrong to think that they are vulnerable, that they do fall apart kind of easily. And that if you can essentially like draw the sting out of the way they play, if you can stop them just ripping through you, Spurs get themselves into trouble quite easily. So this is one of those situations where I'd say it's very early in the season for expected goal numbers. Once we're at 10, it gets a bit better. Once we're at a half season, it gets a bit better. Once we're like 2/3 of the way through the season, we tend to have a good sign. But right now, I would say that Spurs, to me, look more like their results than their underlying numbers. That said, I think they're a bit unlucky to be in ninth. You know, I think they are probably a bit better than that, because if you can batter teams, you can batter teams. There are plus 9 shots per game side. So they're giving up 9 shots fewer than they get, which is enormous. The only side better in the league by that measure is City. Now, that may come back round, you know, like, I don't know, schedule difficulty and, you know, red cards. Again, all that kind of stuff can change it. But really, the reason people are asking, right, is kind of because of that Brighton game. So they went 2-0 up against Brighton. And honestly, Brighton were kind of Spursy in that game. It was like Brighton looked really good, played some really nice football, and Spurs just ripped through them, scored an easy goal, then ripped through them again on the counter-attack, scored a second goal, which, to be honest, was like kind of a crappy chance. It was like a half chance and the keeper should have saved it. But it was like, okay, Brighton look incredibly naive and Spurs just look like a much more... It kind of looked like Arsenal against Spurs at White Hart Lane last season, where it was like, this team doesn't look bad, exactly, but they look like they're playing a much more experienced, canny side. Anyway, all looked great. And then second half, 18 minutes, they lose 3-2. Absolutely disgusting collapse. And the thing is as well, once they went behind in that game, if you look at like the race charts, so if you go to like something like Understat, after Brighton equalise, which is in like the 57th minute, Spurs only have a couple more shots and they only generate about 0.1, 0.15 maximum like expected goals after things are equal. Whereas after Brighton equalise, they go on and add like another 0.6 XG. So when you're looking at score effects in a game like that, you're like, okay, the team that's leading is going to like give up more XG generally and put up less themselves. But once the match is even there, Spurs were not able to get control of it again.
Yeah.
And that to me is kind of the whole problem here. But should we talk a bit about Ange then? Because like when we're talking about control, I do think we have to talk about style.
Sure.
And Ange Ball, I think it's fair to say, is a, I don't know, it's more, it's like a bit more of a knife edge kind of football than like, you know, Arteta and Pep play extremely controlled football. They want games to be super predictable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ange is quite happy to play end-to-end ball.
With Ange, it is absolutely just high risk, high reward. And while that's kind of interesting to watch, it does like lend itself to the famous like Gattuso interview. Sometimes maybe good, sometimes maybe shit. And like fundamentally, that is kind of what Ange under Spurs are. And in this format and in this kind of, if they continue with playing exactly the same way as they have done so far this season, I don't really see how it's going to dramatically change. Like I can't really see them with this system, with how high risk it is, how they can ever truly like absolutely control the vast majority of games well enough to finish in the top four, like consistently. Yeah. And like, if you look at the games they've lost this year, if they're completely understandable, like you lose away to Newcastle and Brighton and at home to Arsenal. Those are three fairly acceptable games to lose. The manner in which they lost is a thing that's concerning. And this is where I think Ange, the system and arguably the personnel within the squad kind of need to be looked at. So one of the big things, one of the riskiest things about Ange is just the height of his defensive line. It is not new to know the Spurs under Ange play a ridiculously high defensive line. It's actually higher this year than it was last year, and people you know were criticizing it last year. So on average so far this season, Spurs' defensive line is set up 36 metres from the baseline. So that's 6 metres higher than last year, and it's also 5 metres higher than Brighton are averaging this year, who also have been kind of criticised slash not criticised, but also has been noted
kamikaze
that Brighton have kind of been recklessly high at points this year, and Spurs are 6 or 5 metres higher than that. And there's one specific player in the squad that affords Ange a little bit more cushion to do things like this, and that's obviously Mickey van de Ven. So his ridiculous pace kind of hides a multitude of sins in that Spurs are able to leave a lot of space behind their offensive line, and more often than not, van de Ven's pace is quick enough to make up the ground if they seem vulnerable, or if balls get played through or over the top, they're not completely absolutely like done by a single ball. However, that is one super risky, because there's only so many times a game that van de Ven can kick that can down the road. Like he just needs to be out of position by 10 metres, the ball go to the wrong place, that he has to cover a lot more ground, and all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, we are giving up a huge chance. He just needs to be slightly slow in reacting, or you know, assessing where the danger is. And then all of a sudden,
And when you're a centre back, like your success rate needs to be 100%. Like
basically,
if you can put an attacker kind of one on one with Van de Ven like three times in a game, asking him to win all of those is a massive requirement. And like, it's not like the rest of the back line is slow. Like Romero's quick, Udogie's quick, but like
Van de Ven's insanely quick though.
He is insanely quick, but you're right. It's basically just saying defend, defend, defend. And I think that's a problem with the whole defense. Like, again, I was just looking at Arsenal because it was easiest. And I think, you know, this is like a very rough and ready way of looking at things. I'm not going to argue that this is an amazing analysis. But I was looking at Arsenal's most used four defenders, and they're attempting 6.6 tackles per 90 between them this season. And Spurs' most used back four are attempting 7.7. Now, that's not a huge difference, But Spurs press really hard. And the whole point of press, Arsenal press pretty hard as well. But the whole reason that you press hard is so that you're winning the ball high up the pitch and your defenders don't have to win the ball constantly. You could also point out that Arsenal have been down to 10 quite a lot and have been defending deep and getting a lot of criticism for it.
And Spurs are also winning the ball higher than any other team bar City as well. So they are winning the ball high, but they're also having to do a lot of defending.
Well, you say that, but Spurs, like, their successful, their tackles in the final third, like, they're actually making the same number of tackles in the final third as Arsenal, despite the fact that they press so hard. So you're like, the reward for pressing this high is there, but it's not like you're getting so much more from everybody else that it justifies, like, this kind
the
of
effort
shit.
That they have
so,
to do,
yeah, so I just kind of think, like, why is the defense so exposed? And the simple answer is, I think, the press is not very well coordinated. Like, when you see guys go and press, it feels like quite often it's easy to play through them. I don't think that their attacking line are amazing pressers. They've also been playing an extremely attacking midfield. You know, like, they've been playing Maddison deep. They've been playing Kulusevski deep. Like, this is good for lots of things, but defensive solidity is not one of them. And when one guy goes and presses, then the guys around him have to go and press as well. They have to close down all the options. But I feel like with Spurs, while sometimes it's effective, sometimes it's like embarrassingly easy to play through them. Even in the United game where United, you know, were kind of rubbish, there were quite a lot of points that United did just like pass through Spurs midfield and get away, or they passed over the top and they get away from them. And I think, well, your very, very aggressive press should be less easy to get around than this, you know? Like, it's, it feels like, you know, we want to praise Spurs for pressing really hard, but like, if it's not joined up to sensible plans for teams that go long, sensible plans for like when teams get past the first line of the press, then you're just being reckless. I don't know. I mean, I know you've got some other weaknesses noted down here as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just like on the relationship between the press, quickly before we move on, just on the relationship between the press and like defensive, like the defensive line being exposed. What I find interesting was, if you look at, obviously, seven games a season isn't that big a sample size and you can't really draw a huge amount of conclusions from it. But if you look at last season, their press was actually slightly, or their defensive line was slightly lower. So theoretically, there is literally less space for teams to play and exploit in behind. But Spurs conceded 61 goals last season, which was like 1.6 per game, over double Arsenal's tally.
That's so many.
But when you look at the games in which they played Romero, Udogi, Van de Ven and Porro, when they all played together, that was 15 games of that 38 game season. They only conceded 17 in that time, 1.1 a game.
That's still quite a lot.
But that would have been good enough for fourth. If you extrapolate that across a 38 game season, that would have finished fourth, the fourth best defensive record in the league. Now, Van de Ven got injured and Ben Davies came in and deputised. In that nine games where Ben Davies played the kind of Van de Ven role, Spurs conceded 16 goals. 1.8 a game. So not only is this press kind of leaving this defence exposed, this defensive line and this defensive system and the height at which they're playing at and the roles in which they're expected to fulfil is so dependent on Van de Ven and his like very individual abilities that once you try and filter him out and replace him with a person who is obviously not as good, otherwise they would be in the starting line, but also who has different qualities, like, it becomes really problematic. We're already talking about it being problematic when they have their full outfit available. When you start subbing in players from their squad, and I suppose we'll come on to squad depth, kind of personnel generally, in a bit, but I find that really, really stark. Like, that is a real departure from, like, pretty good defence, or at least respectable defence, to fucking hell, this is, like, quite bad, and really kind of easy to walk through. And that's a concern. It feels like this system for Ange is built on it's a house of cards. It doesn't take a lot for it to come tumbling down. And we've seen that in games already this season.
But it's also, but then that almost puts the focus in the wrong place, because that basically says Van de Ven's so important and he gets injured. Like, it's really rough for Spurs. It's going to hurt them. It is going to hurt them. But the fact that when that happened, they did not adjust. They just tried to play the same thing with like an former left back playing. I don't know, because like it's kind of like there are plenty of teams who have a plan for when their kind of unicorn goes down, right? Like there are plenty of teams who are like, we're going to play a different way. So again, I know I'm using Arsenal a lot, but like Ødegaard gets injured. And what have Arsenal done rather than trying to create really high value chances, they've just tried to pile on like lots of half chances. They've put up like, I think it's something like 66 shots in their last two games. And the whole idea seems to have been, we will get through with sheer weight of shots. That is a reasonable response to losing one of, well, Saka might be turning into that guy, but losing basically the one guy in your squad who is like a super elite chance creator.
Yeah.
I think that's sensible. Similarly, you know, Spurs should just have a plan for this.
Yeah.
Like, just play a different way. I don't understand. Play a different formation if you have to, but operate in a different manner. And it's like, I don't know. I know what you're getting at. But all I'm saying is that quite often at the end of a season, people say, "Well, of course, you know, we didn't do as well as we should have because our best player got injured." And you're like, "Well, sometimes that does hurt, and sometimes there are players who are irreplaceable. You know, like Rodri, like Saka, like Salah. But sometimes you're like, defenses can adjust." I'm not saying they can adjust and still be as good without like your best defender, but you can adjust so that your team is just like not fucking wide open and giving up two goals a game because you're playing Ben Davis like in the way that like Arsenal use Saliba or something. Like, it's insane business. I don't know what they're doing. And I think there are other data points here that make me a bit concerned about Ange. Like, so for example, there's obviously been like the set piece controversy. He was like, he says it's overblown, but at the same time, they keep giving up set piece goals. They give up set piece goals all the time. And then
three
the other match,
the season.
Yeah.
Almost 40% of the goals this season are set piece goals.
Jesus. And it's just like kind of easy. You're like, it's not that hard to create those chances against them. It's not like people are running like super elite moves. Like, look, the Arsenal one, I think, is a bit dodgy. You know, that could easily have been given as a foul. But at the same time, you know Arsenal are going to come and try and get Gabriel free for set pieces. It's not good that you're not kind of prepared for it. And then there's... and also the fact that in that game when they needed a goal, they were just like hoofing in crosses at a massive Arsenal back line who were just completely happy to just nod it away. You're a really attacking side. So you don't have a plan for when a team shells really deep against you and they're actually a good defence? Or, well, look, I mean, Arsenal can do that. They did it to City as well. They kind of did it to Atalanta. Like, okay, maybe Arsenal just do that to you. But how do you not have an idea of something to do other than whipping crosses at two massive centre-backs who are completely happy to head it away all day? Why would you play exactly the way that Arsenal want you to, which is to play low percentage balls into the box to your front line, which is not especially big? I just don't really get that kind of stuff. And Ange does say these things where he's like, we're not going to change the way we play. Like, this is like really important. Like, this is a style we're committed to. And I'm in a group chat for the transfer flow. And one guy in that who is a football analyst, like works for different teams, was like, when a manager says something like this, I think you should fire that guy immediately. Now, I'm not saying you should do that with Ange, but like he was talking about Russell Martin, I think, when he said this. But it's like, but I think Arteta made a good point about it when he was kind of quizzed by the press about like why he was playing a certain way when he was down to 10 men. He said, I'd like to wear flip-flops and shorts, but the context is important. If I wear those things now, you're going to say I'm an idiot to go out in the cold and the rain wearing them. But I could say, well, actually, I'm being very brave. And you're like, it's the same thing. It's all very well to say, oh, we went down to 10 men, but we were very, very brave. Yeah, but you lost the game.
Yeah.
And
we played attractive football and lost. Great.
Yes. And also, sometimes they're not playing particularly attractive football. I didn't think it was attractive football at the end against Arsenal. But come on, guys. Like, I just think that it concerns me that the press is not, as aggressive as it is, it's not that well coordinated, I don't think. It concerns me that they don't have plans for kind of obvious major problems that they might run into. It concerns me that they run out of ideas quite easily, even when they're playing an extremely attacking lineup. All this stuff, I don't feel great about.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there's, I don't know, should we come on to this leadership question then? Because when it comes to the Brighton game, there was obviously a feeling as well that they did like crumble. It wasn't just that they, you know, realistically, Ange is not encouraging his team to go out at 2-0 up and just like completely sacrifice control of the game You know, it's not like he's sent them out with a radically different plan in the second half.
Yeah.
But it did feel like they got scared and the pressing wasn't as coherent. And I don't know, it feels all soft stuff because it's like conviction in the tackle and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But in that second half, they honestly just looked shit scared and went to pieces. And this is kind of the point that Joshua was bringing up about leadership. And it's kind of always the knock on Spurs, right? They don't have anybody who gets them up when the shit gets tough.
Yeah. I think it is a completely fair criticism. It's a completely fair point. And in part, I do definitely agree. But I think the definition of what is leadership is quite important here. And I think it's easy to look at like a Roy Keane or Patrick Vieira and be like, that's leadership. You know, Spurs don't have that. And they don't have that. But that's not to say that they don't have leaders within their squad. I think it's the issue is kind of how those leaders in their squad can affect things on the pitch when they're up against it or when tides start to turn negatively. So if you look at Spurs as like big players, who are their big players? Obviously, Son is their captain, but he's never been a leader in the way that where Keane was a leader. That doesn't mean he's not a leader, but it does mean that he does have certain shortcomings in certain scenarios. Not least in the fact that he plays left wing as well, which is a problem. Not a problem, but it adds to the fact that it would perhaps be more difficult for him to, say, take the game by the scruff of the neck and turn his entire team's tides on his own. If you think about performances of, like, I keep coming back to Roy Keane, but like Roy Keane in the Champions League semi-final against Juventus. He was on a yellow card, he knew he was missing the final. Like, that performance when United were in the shit, that was like a really famous kind of like, let's just fucking dig in and get shit done. Spurs don't really have that because their leaders aren't in those positions. You know, they've got Son, their vice captain is Romero. Romero is kind of the one who can do that. Their other vice captain is James Maddison, who's only been at the club for a season and is, again, another attacking player, plays. While he's kind of been deployed a little bit deeper, he is still not offering a huge amount defensively. He is an attack-minded player. Him and Son are very much, we will influence the game attacking-wise hugely, but defensively, we're not passengers, but we have significantly less influence defensively than we do attacking-wise.
I want it to be Maddison and Bentancur, if I'm a Spurs fan. I want like Bentancur to be like, I've played for Juventus, and also I'm Uruguayan. Like, so like I'm up for a scrap here and I'm going to like take control of this. And I want Maddison to be like Odegaard, where he's like, give me the ball constantly and I will make it happen. Give me the ball again and again and again and again.
Just give me the ball. I think Odegaard's significantly better than Maddison though.
Sure, but leadership doesn't mean that you're always like doing everything perfectly. Like sometimes, like the leader doesn't have to be like the most talented player on the pitch. As for Son, I think he's kind of hamstrung by his age here. Like the reason that we're talking about Son as a leader is just because he's been there a long time, not because he seems to really have those. Because like guy who sent this question in, Joshua, he was like, "Oh, well, Saka's grown into a leader for Arsenal." Well, Saka's a winger too. I don't really know if Saka is a winger like he gets the team going, but certainly he is. Like Salah, oh, you can give him the ball and maybe he'll create something out of nothing. Yeah. So he's a leader in that sense. Well, Son used to be that guy, but like, it's a big ask when he's in his 30s and they don't have those sorts of wingers. You know, the guys who are like, he beats three guys, he's an elite dribbler, and then he creates a massive chance for himself or for somebody else. Like, they simply don't have those sorts of wingers. They kind of have runners and then they have midfield passers.
I think the narrative around this, whether Spurs have leaders or not, will be completely different if the Son role, like that part of the squad, the older guy who used to be amazing and is slightly declining, a little bit in and out of the team, three injuries. If he was a six, sure, we wouldn't be having these questions because everyone would be like, that's a guy, he's involved in everything and the kind of role he plays gives the team a much more stable base. I think the fact that these big players are one at centre-back and then left-wing and then you're expecting Maddison to be maybe some, you expect him to really step up, in my opinion, as well. If you're expecting him to do that Odegaard role with that leadership, with the weight on his shoulders, after one season at Spurs for a team with his lofty expectations at Spurs, I think that is a fairly big ask for a player like Maddison. I think Madison's good. I think Maddison was fantastic at the start of last season and stumbled a bit when he came back after injury. I think that's a big ask for a guy who's in his position.
But I think you only say that because it's Maddison. Like, if it was somebody else in that position, like, after a season at United, Bruno absolutely was that guy.
But Bruno was better than Maddison.
so what? Like, it's Spurs are not that good. Like, I mean, I don't really think that's the problem. Like, they don't, you don't need to be incredible to not go to pieces when you're 2-0 up away from home, you know? Like, you just need somebody who's like, who gets their foot on the ball and calms things down, or who goes to everybody and they're just like, do your fucking jobs. Or when you need a goal, they're like, give me the ball. Like, give me the ball and I'll at least put it in the right place. But even if I'm not, even if I'm not the De Bruyne, I can get the ball to the guy who is. You know, like, give me that responsibility. There are lots of players who can do that, who I don't think, like Roy Keane was a very talented player. But Roy
Keane
was
far more talented than people give him credit for.
But he was not anywhere near the most talented player in that side. He was not really the guy who made things happen. But he was not scared of anything, and he always made the right decision on the ball, pretty much.
He was a real tone setter.
He just got the ball and was simple about it. Like, when Arteta played for Arsenal, he was like that. Like, Arteta was like not the most talented player in the world, but he was super intelligent. And so he'd get the ball and he'd do the right thing with it. And there's a lot of value in that. And like, if Madison got the ball and just like kept probing, kept moving the ball forward, that's often what Odegaard does for Arsenal. It's not necessarily that he picks the ball up and like creates a massive chance out of nowhere in the last minutes. It's that he goes and picks the ball up from the centre backs, runs forward, gives it to the right player. And then when the ball comes back out, he presses, he recycles, and he does it again. And this is the thing, the kind of thing that I think leadership is actually made of. However, I do think it would be nice if you could sign a player for Spurs in a position of need who was also a leader. You know, I think that would be lovely. Realistically, I think that's quite hard to do because teams don't want to sell those kinds of guys. And it's quite hard to sign, like, well, you're talking about a new guy coming in and being a leader. And in order for them to immediately be seen that way, they're probably an older player.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just don't think it really works.
As a 23-year-old, it's difficult.
Exactly. So I think you've got to sign guys who turn into those leaders. If we're saying Odegaard's a leader for Arsenal, Odegaard wasn't even particularly good his first half season at Arsenal. He was okay, but it was only by the end of that first year that everyone was like, my God, this is the guy.
Yeah.
People wanted Madison instead of him that summer. So I think if you can't go and buy leaders, what you actually do is buy the talent to address the problems you have. I think buying the talent to control a game without exposing yourself is more important than going and buying a leader. So I think if Spurs had really good, had one or two really good number sixes, they could play more conservatively when up a goal. They could hold the ball. They could prevent teams like Brighton gaining momentum. Now, you can call that leadership, and I think players who do that often get called leaders. But I really do just think that that is a profile issue. You know, Spurs, what we're saying is Spurs have one gear, which is like they come at you as hard as they can. And if it stops working, then they're like, oh shit, they're playing through us. Oh God, do we drop off? Do we keep pressing? What happens? Oh, they've scored three goals.
Sure.
And I think it makes more sense, and we'll come on to this in a second, like, it makes more sense for me to just say, like, we need a couple of profiles in here that enable us to play a slightly different way when we're up a goal, that enable us to play a slightly different way when we're under pressure. Like, if in that Brighton game, after Brighton had scored, Spurs had had guys who are more talented on the ball, I don't think it would have mattered if they weren't leaders. If they could have just passed it around and kept it and stopped Brighton, like, pressing them and coming at them relentlessly, I think that would have been totally fine. Like, you don't need the most talented guys in the world. Like, you just need people who are exceptionally reliable on the ball, and that will do it. And over time, and then that's how you draw the sting out of a game. So I mean, I don't know, shall we move on to transfers, or is there anything else that you want to cover before we get there?
I don't want to go too long on this. I think, yeah, I mean, we don't really want to backtrack on the stuff we've already covered. But yeah, we can move on to transfers. I think, like, the last thing I had in this section was basically, like, it was trying to put a positive spin on Spurs' position in that their expected position currently is fourth. And the only team with, like, a bigger deficit between their expected position versus their actual position is Bournemouth. So it feels like for Spurs that the results they've got, while predicted to be fair, or they were on a little bit on the unlucky side, and that over a season that it should come out in the wash, and theoretically, it should come out in the wash, and they should finish significantly higher than ninth. I think Optus predicted them, Newcastle and Villa, to finish within a point of each other, less than a point of each other, between fifth and seventh. And I think that's kind of fair. I think that's probably where Spurs will finish, somewhere between fifth and seventh. I don't know if it'll be that tight, but I think I struggle to see them breaking into the top four. Somewhere between 5th and 7th feels about right. When they're good, they're really good. When they're not good, they are really not good. And if Ange is coming out in press conferences saying we're not going to change the way we play, I feel like this is kind of what's going to transpire across the entire season. And it feels like they're going to finish like fifth or sixth for me.
Yeah, and I think he could learn. I think he could improve in that regard.
He could.
But I still think the squad is pretty thin. They're pressing pretty hard. They're going to get tired. They can maybe go and do some stuff in January, but probably not like a whole bunch of stuff. They could probably go and get a couple of people if they wanted, but at a premium.
This
I don't
is the
know.
Thing, and Spurs as a club, like historically, do not wish to pay that premium.
And I just wait. Like, I don't know if you're going to, like, maybe if you get there and you're like within a point of Chelsea or whoever it is, who I think are maybe the favourites for fourth.
Based on how they've started, yeah. I would say.
Then I think if you're like close to them, then maybe you think, okay, we can get two guys and we can beat them to it. But generally speaking, probably whatever Spurs do, barring something insane, they're going to finish fifth to seventh. So you might as well finish fifth to seventh. However, seeing as somebody asked, I think there are some players that they can look at. I think as they're buying attackers going forward, they need to prioritize attackers who can press really well. I think they've got a lot of attackers who will press okay, but who are not particularly talented at it. Like, Son is now pretty old. I don't think your midfielders like Kulusevski and Maddison are particularly good at it. Johnson's okay. He can run a lot, but he's not really your presser. He's the guy who stays high so you can find him. Solanke is okay. He's not amazing. Like, I just look around all these guys. Like, Timo Werner will work hard, like, but he's not amazing at it either. Like, if you could add a couple of people in there who are like super elite forward line pressers, that would honestly go such a long way. Like, if you dropped like a Martinelli or a Luis Diaz in that Spurs team, I'm not really just talking about their talent, like when they're on the ball, but just their work rate off the ball, I think would be such a weapon for Spurs. Like, Richarlison does a pretty good job, I will say, but you know, Richarlison's not playing. So I don't know. I think that would help with the fact the attack gets bypassed quite a lot when they press. I would probably target a couple of midfielders. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about profiles. So what I'd
sixers.
Want in that midfield, two different kinds of sixes.
Yeah,
though.
But sixers.
One, super, super, super mobile ball winner.
Yeah.
Like, that guy doesn't need to be like the greatest passer in the world, but they need to be decent on the ball. But the main thing is they need to be fast and they need to just fucking kill people.
The key.
Like, you need somebody who's all over the pitch all the time, super mobile, can shut attacks down, shields your back line. You need Rice, like someone like Rice. Like, it doesn't have to be someone like Conte does it that way, but like someone who's just all over the pitch. And the other profile, I think, is just someone who's a very, very press-resistant passer. So that person needs to be more of a game controller type.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're two goals up. Yeah. They've got a goal back. I'm just going to pass it around. I'm going to offer for the ball and pass it around. And that's how we're going to play. And that's completely fine. So I thought an interesting... So for that second role, you're not going to get him because he's refusing to go anywhere. But a Zubimendi type is the type you want. Like, I don't think... Like, when you... If you want a ball winner in your side, Zubimendi's like, okay, but he's not great at it. The thing is, he will do a bit of it while being extremely press resistant, very, very, very calm. I don't think Bentancur has ended up being what Spurs hoped they'd be. He'd be Bissouma, ditto. Papsar, I like, but he's much more of an eight. He's much more aggressive. I
also
want him to have that freedom.
Still.
Exactly. So... A Zubimendi type, he should be kind of the prototype there. As for the defensive guy, the ball winner, and actually he might be better than this, but there's a guy called Nicolò Rovella who plays for Lazio. He's technically on loan from Juve with an obligation to buy, but he's 22.
Mm-hmm.
He's at 5.3 defensive actions per 90 this season for Lazio, and he was somewhere between 4 and 5 last season. But he's also passing into the final third quite a bit, 5 times a game. 90% pass accuracy despite playing a lot of long balls, and really good success on his long balls as well. He never gets dispossessed. He dribbles a little bit. So he's decent at everything, but he's really, really good at ball winning. And when you look at him, he's not super tall. I think he's like just under 5'11", but he's pretty lanky. And I think as he fills out, he'll be quite... If you watch him go shoulder to shoulder with attackers, he's really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And he's super agile. Quite often, you know, like... There'll be a tackle, the ball will squirm away, and he will get to it before somebody else gets there. He turns really quickly. He's really nice on the ball, and he's comfortable playing left-footed, even though he's right-footed. He'd be a really interesting target for Spurs. And maybe, you know, maybe Bergfile will end up being this guy. Like, I don't really know. Maybe Archie Gray and Bergfile, like, transform this team. because you know, they've bet quite a bit of money on that. Like, that's totally fine. So they may have solutions in the squad. I think that, to be honest, given the way the season looks right now, it's worth gambling on those guys. Because I'm not sure there's that much point blooding them gently when I don't think that your season's really going to, like, explode. Like, yeah. Like as in you're not going to finish, like, 12th if you play those guys all the time.
Yeah.
But right now, I also don't think that you've really got a possibility of finishing higher than 5th at best.
Yeah.
So why not just, like, take a big swing and start playing those guys? I just think that's an option.
I think also then, if you do that, you're able to take stock more accurately at the end of the season. Because realistically, I don't see Spurs going big in January. They're just not the club to do it. And even if they were a little bit off Chelsea and kind of hunting down fourth, I'm still not convinced that they will kind of put all their eggs in one basket and go for that fourth, like, spend a lot of money just to get fourth. If you blood in these players that could fill those roles and those positions, even if it doesn't work out, come summer, you're like, okay, didn't work out. Now we definitely know what we need, as opposed to now we know what we might need. But also, we've got these guys that we already spent a lot of money on.
Yeah. And, like, maybe they're great. Like, they're super young.
Yeah.
Like, Bergvall is, like, 18.
How old's Archie Gray?
And I think Archie Gray must be about the same. He must be 19.
He is 18 and 218 days.
Fucking hell. Okay, so both these guys are 18.
Yeah.
Is it ideal to be playing those guys all the time? No. But given how notional the defensive midfield is at Spurs right now, it's like it's there, but not really. I just don't see what you have to lose from playing them. I would play them, and if at the end of the season you're like, these guys aren't good enough, they're not going to be good enough for a while, then go and get Rovella, go and get Niklas Seiwald from Leipzig. He's another kind of player. And gradually try and, like, work through. You should probably do that anyway. I think they should maybe move on some people this summer. I don't think it really matters who they are, to be honest with you. But, like, I really love Kulusevski. I always loved him. But, like, I'm not convinced that, like, the best Spurs team of the future has him in it. Maybe it does. The problem is they've got people like Madison and Solanke. Like, those are good players. Don't get me wrong. But they're much older, and those are kind of the guys that you'd want to be moving on, like, versus Kulusevski at 24. Yeah. So I don't really know what the plan is there with squad building, but Spurs supposedly have a little bit of money. If they went and got one of these midfielders next summer, I think that would be super smart. And this is like a 23-year-old he would be then, rather than an 18-year-old. Buy some of these middle age players, but you know what I mean, who can contribute now. And I just think...
Says the 35-year-old to the 33-year-old.
Sure. but if you get some guys like that and you're still having this problem, you know, this leadership problem in a couple of years' time, then we can talk about it again. But I don't think it's worth talking about leadership when I can look at the field and I can look at the players you've got and I can see problems with it, you know?
Yeah.
If you've got an amazing midfield and you're like, there are no leaders in there, then maybe I can get on board with that. But when I look at your midfield and I'm like, yeah, well, these guys just aren't that good at the shit that you need them to do when you're playing this high line, then I think there's a much simpler solution, which is sign some guys who can do that stuff. Okay, that's the end of Spurs. Thank God for that. That brings us on to the burn book. Pete, in, out, you, me. Ooh, that sounded very saucy.
yeah, it sounded, okay, it sounded like a proposition.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Who knows? what do you want to start with this week?
Okay, I'm going to start with what's going in the burn book this week. And for me, this is actually going to be quite quick. Because these shouldn't exist. And as far as I'm concerned, these are just... If he existed or they existed, these would be the devil's work.
Oh my God.
What's going in the burn book this week for me are decorative pillows.
What the fuck? Okay.
Decorative pillows. Like, this is a concept that I've never understood. They have no place in society. What sick person looked at, like, a made bed with, like, you know, your standard one or two pillows on either side for sleeping and thought, do you know what will make this better? 10 more pillows stacked back to front in decreasing size.
Yeah.
What? Explain to me why that is needed.
They take up like half the bed sometimes.
It's nonsense, right? So not only that, you'd maybe look at the bed and say, okay, that has got like 15 pillows on it. That's going to be really, really comfy, isn't it? Nope. The majority of those pillows are not functional pillows. They're actually really uncomfortable because they've got like fucking sequins on them or like decorative knots on them that make
them
essentially
cushions.
Unusable.
They're not pillows, they're cushions.
What's the difference?
Well, to me, a cushion belongs on a sofa, you know, as in you're like, it's got like, it's made of like velvet and it's a bit hard, whereas a pillow...
But it still has a function.
Yeah, but
you mean the actual like seated cushion that's part of the sofa?
I mean an added cushion.
Right.
But my point is that like an added cushion on a sofa, I don't like it, but I can live with it. Whereas sometimes on a bed, I'm like, the only version of this there should be on a bed is a pillow, which is a very specific type of thing. It's a type of cushion, but you can't just put any old cushion on a bed and think that that's okay. So you know when they're really hard, they're like, yeah, they've got like velvet covers, they've got tassels on and all that shit. I'm like, no, pillow or and nothing else is allowed here.
I draw the line at functionality. Is it functional? If it's not functional, doesn't need to be in the bed. Like, I've never looked at a bed and said, you know what that needs? More pillows, unless there are no pillows on that bed.
Or one pillow. I like to have a second.
So Jess is two, I historically have one.
But if you went to a hotel and there was one pillow on the bed, you'd be like, that's fucking stingy. Give me another pillow.
Exactly, yeah. So when we go to hotels, there are two pillows. Jess uses both, and then I take one off and put it on the floor.
Which is fine.
That is completely fine. I'm fine with those, because both of those pillows are functional per person. Mm-hmm. Both functional. Mm-hmm. This is just an absolute exercise in futility. And outside of that, even once you break down the kind of the rigmarole that revolves around having... Now, also, side note, this is not my life. We do not have any decorative pillows. Jess is not a decorative pillow person, at least not on like our bed. This was kind of born out of me seeing like basically viral clips online of these women basically bitching out their other halves for not appropriately or not correctly following the 25-step plan to reassemble their bed that morning. And then the comments were like, oh, like fucking, I don't know, get a new boyfriend or whatever. Or like, this is like not slay. I don't know, fucking trying to be Gen Z.
This is not slay.
This is not fetch. This is so sus. This is not skibbity. Is that the word that they use? Skibbity?
I don't know what that means.
I think it means good. I think it's like, I think skibbity sigma.
Can't mean good.
No, I think skibbity sigma is like some like a very popular person. Like somebody you aspire to be. Skibbity.
Sorry.
It's not nonsense.
A skibbity sigma is somebody...
I'm familiar with sigma, but skibbity sigma.
I didn't know you could use those together. I hate that. Fuck that.
I have some friends who are teachers across primary and secondary school, and apparently the phrase skibbity sigma is like... It's used an insane amount.
That makes me want to commit a violent act. I hate that. That's awful. But, fuck that.
Yeah, so basically, that was kind of how this kind of came on my radar and just kind of pissed me off. Because, one, I don't think they should be there in the first place. Two, I don't want to spend 5 minutes taking them off and like putting them to the side of the rooms just so I can get into bed. Three, I don't want to spend 15 minutes the next morning having to rearrange them in a certain set order to achieve the like previous aesthetic. And similarly, I don't want to play fucking dark obstacle course when I want to get up in the middle of the night and take a piss. Like, I don't want to have to try and navigate in the pitch black around 15 pillows on the ground just to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
Like, it's everything about this is absolute nonsense. And add to that, they're not even cheap. They're like 40 quid a pillow.
Yeah.
So the amount you're spending to just grossly inconvenience yourself is staggering.
It's not even a room that people see when they come to your house.
It's like when your parents would be like, clean your room, we've got guests coming over. You'd be like, well, are the guests going to eat in my room?
Like why the like, fuck no. are they going in my room? Yeah. I'm 12.
Yeah. But yeah, it's such a good point in that it's a vanishingly small amount of people who spend any amount of time, any significant amount of time in your marital bedroom other than you and your wife.
Or your child. But it's for fucking like TikTok and shit. It's for fucking Instagram. So you're like, look at how I make my bed. And it's like, I don't want to fucking see it. I don't want to see those psychopaths, you know, who like iron their bed and they do
it. It's very Patrick Bateman-y, isn't it?
Oh my God, it's gross. Or the people who are like, this is how I stack my fridge with like 100 cans of Diet Coke. It's just like, shut the fuck up and don't drink that much Diet Coke because it's full of sweeteners that are laxatives in large quantities. Like, don't do it. Like, okay, this is actually going to lead into my thing in a bit. But I agree with this. Like, it reminds me of, I can't remember who it was, some restaurant critic. It was probably like Jay Rayner or someone years ago who was just like, you know, when you go to a restaurant and there's like some cylinder of food and it's like standing upright, there's some fucking like tower constructed in front of you. And it's like, the first thing I have to do is knock over this tower in order to eat. That's how I feel about these beds. I'm like, the first thing I should have to do in order to get into bed shouldn't be deconstruct the bed.
Yeah.
So that it's so a usable bed. I want to walk in. The whole point of a made bed is that it's really nice to walk into the room and get straight into the bed rather than like walk into the room, fucking undo this, like, you know, like I'm trying to like fucking find Jesus's body, like in the tomb. I've got to like move all this shit aside, like, so that I can climb into my fucking bed. Bullshit. I hate it. I also don't like all this decorative stuff. Like, I'm really, really, really anti-coaster. I hate coasters.
I'm fine with coasters because they serve a function.
Fuck coasters. They're stupid.
But they serve a function. They're protected.
Yeah, but they're a stupid function. Like, the idea of having a tiny little table to put on your table for you to put a drink on, that's what the fucking table's for. Just get a table that's got a bit more, like, a bit more about it. Like, when we were buying a dining room table.
You do want a table with a bit more leadership.
Yeah, exactly. One table that, like, wants it a bit more, you know? Yeah. Like, so like, when we were buying a new dining table, when we moved to this house, I said to Emma, I was just like, we're not getting a dining table that can't handle, like, a hot cup on it. That's bullshit. I'm not having a fucking stack of coasters that every time someone leaves the house, I've got to go and like stack them up and replace them in some spot in the room. It's just another load of fucking clutter. I just find it unbearably precious that it's just like, oh, put that on a coaster. It's like, I'm not going to spill my drink. You know how I know that? Because I'm a fucking adult. That's how. I'm an adult, so I'm not going to spill my drink. And if I do spill my drink, I'm not going to spill it onto the coaster. I'm going to spill it probably on myself or on the floor or on the sofa. Like, it's going to be an accident and therefore not predictable and therefore not confined to the coaster. So I just find the coaster stuff, like, the people who are into it, it's always like, oh, I've got to protect my little table. Like, why? You shouldn't have a varnished table anyway. It's 2024, you fucking embarrassment. So, like, there are just things like that where
we have a glass coffee table and it leaves rings. So I'm pro coaster because coaster
well,
function.
It's not the 90s anymore, Pete. Don't have a glass coffee table. Like, you're not a single man in 1990s New York. Like, you're a normal person in 2024.
Maybe.
Don't put yourself down like that. Like, I think you could be Patrick Bateman. But I understand that it leaves rings, but I just think that, like, coasters are fucking stupid. I just think get a table that doesn't
that. Coasters are functional. Decorative pillows by design are not functional.
I understand. I do think that's a fair distinction. What am I putting in? I was going to put something in about this Thomas Tuchel thing, but I just don't think I can put a football thing in. I don't think it's acceptable to talk about football in the Burn Book, so I've changed my mind. What I'm going to put in is street interviews on Vox social pops. Media. But it's never like a Vox Pop where it's like, we're trying to get the whole point of Vox Pop, like literally the meaning of Vox Pop, right, is like voice of the people. Like, we want to get a sense of like the general vibe. These things, I think, specifically do not do that. So it'll be, we interviewed a bunch of drunk girls outside a club and they were all just like, yeah, if you don't earn 100k a year like, you know, you don't have a 10-inch dick and a six pack and 100k a year, like, I just wouldn't date you. And you're just like, this is the aim of this video. Like, you're interviewing someone when they're drunk and you're trying to get them to say their worst opinion.
Yeah.
And you're trying to make me hate them or feel bad about myself.
It's like the Hawks here girl.
Sure, but I mean, like, I don't know, that's kind of funny. Like,
that is,
as in, like, she's not funny, but I'm just like, yeah, okay, she just said like an unguarded thing. Like, I'm kind of okay with that.
A nice,
like,
career out of it.
It's more when they do, yeah, when it's stuff that I think is designed to make the audience feel bad and feel angry. So I saw one the other day that was just like stopping people in London, young people, like people in their 20s, and just saying like, how much do you have in your bank account? And literally the entire video,
oh yeah, like, to see
nobody said under £10,000. everybody was just like 22k, like 15k, like 27k, and I was just like, this is not representative, this is bullshit, and all this is gonna make you do is feel bad about yourself if you're in your 20s. I don't see the point of this. This is not an accurate representation of the world. It's just stupid. I feel the same way about these, like, these interviews about fashion, you know, where they'll be like, I would just never wear like X or Y, you know, just some fucking popular thing. And where they say, oh, go through your outfit. And somebody's like, well, I'm wearing these shoes. They're like, you know, the Margiela Tabbies, and I'm wearing these La Mer trousers, and I'm wearing this coat from fucking, you know, Rick Owens or whatever. And I've got this bag. Oh, and I'm wearing my like Cartier tank. And you're like, okay, right. So at the end of this, this person's wearing 15 grand's worth of shit. Like,
well, with a Cartier tank?
Sure. You know, at the end of it, I'm just like, this, who is this for? Who is this content for? You're just asking this person who has insane money and potentially works in fashion to make everybody at home who doesn't have that money feel bad about themselves. Like, all this stuff all the time. I also think it's just incredibly bad for gender relations, because 90% of the time it's like young women being asked, like, what would you do if a man didn't pay on the first date? How much should a man earn if he wants to be with you? Like, what, you know, like, what is your red flag? You know, like, all this kind of shit, you know, like, what are the things that, like, would turn you off? How do you get the ick?
Yeah.
Like, all this kind of stuff. And you just think, if you look at the comments on this stuff, it's normally a bunch of women saying, like, we don't really think that way. It's the occasional woman being like, yeah, queen, like, why would you accept anything worse? And you're like, well, that's just bullshit. I don't believe you. I bet that your boyfriend's a fucking piece of shit. And then a bunch of young men who are just like, fuck these women, like, fuck them, how dare they? And I just think all this does is give people a complete misapprehension of how the other gender thinks about things, one of the other genders, how they think about things. Sure. Like, it makes you feel lonelier and more inadequate. And I never see one of these that I find enlightening. In fact, the only one of them, I saw one a couple of days ago, and it wasn't enlightening, but I liked it because it was an incredibly drunk girl outside a club. And they were just like, how much does a man have to earn to be with you? And she was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, it doesn't matter. If I really like someone, I'll be with him. And if you're at home worried that you're not making enough money, recognize that the girl who makes you feel that you're not making enough money doesn't really want to be with you. You shouldn't waste your time on her. And I was just like, yeah, exactly. Fucking right. Like, this little drunk 21-year-old is like spitting wisdom. But I think that if I were 22 now, I had like no money when I was 22. My career was kind of like wobbling all over the place. I didn't think I was really going to make it in film, which I ultimately didn't. I guess I was single at that point. Like, I was just like fucking lonely and miserable. But if I had to consume all this shit, I would have felt even fucking worse. And I'd have felt like everybody out there in the world was an arsehole who would never see anything good in me. I just think it's really fucking bad for people. And these pricks who are just like collaring people on the street, where they're just like, what are the worst shoes? What item of clothing would you never wear? What item of clothing would you just fucking like kill yourself if you saw someone wearing? Like, all this kind of stuff. I'm just like, you're an arsehole. You're just like stirring up division to make people feel bad. And ultimately, the people you're making feel bad are like 14-year-olds or 22-year-olds. People who do not have, I don't know, a robust sense of self.
Yeah, they're not figured that out yet.
I just think it's stupid, evil bullshit. And also, it's never even funny. It's always crap. Like, every now and then, you get, like, somebody saying, like, you know, hawk to her. Which I'm just like, you know, it's fine. Spin, but it's not thing. Like, yeah. But it's not really, like, worth it. Or there's an even worse genre where it's just a guy, you know, where he'll be like, would you date this guy? And he shows a girl picture of, like, a guy with that. So, and then he takes his shirt off and he's like, it's me! I've got abs! Oh, my God! And the girls are just like, oh, fucking go away, you pervert. Yeah. Like,
but then there's also the ones where someone like shows you, like, they go up and say, rate yourself between 1 to 10, and then he takes a picture of you and then goes to the next person and says, rate this person, and then compares like the self rating versus the actual person's rating, and then continues down the line, and it's just kind of gross.
Just like, miss me with this bullshit. Like, get the fuck out of here. I just think we should start taking phones off people. If somebody came up to me and they were just like, hi, can I just talk to you? Like, I was just wondering, you know, like, what's your red flag? I'd be like, I'm calling the fucking police. Like, I should be able to perform a citizen's execution on you. Like, if you are this person, because you're not adding anything to the world. Like, you're genuinely sowing division.
Free speech isn't for everyone.
Free speech is not for everyone. You should have a fucking license for it. anyway, what are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book this week is Adam Brody.
Oh, my boy.
Brody.
He is still as fine as can be.
Unbelievable. The world thought Seth Cohen was gone for good. The world thought
he married Blair Waldorf.
The world thought he was lost in the fucking mid-noughties. But no, he's back and he is, like you say, as fit as ever. Like,
oh, he's so hot.
And ironically, in my opinion, absolutely everybody wanted this. Which is ironic because the show that kind of propelled him back in the public light was Nobody Wants It.
I think if you'd asked me when I was 18, like, if you could watch like two people actually fuck, I'd be like Kristen Bell, Adam Brody, pretty high up on the list. I'd have been like, I'll watch that. That sounds great.
But like, I forgot how much I loved the like Seth Cohen character until I watched Nobody Wants This, which is completely fine. Like, it's decent. I think it's 8.1 rating on IMDb is a bit of a stretch.
That's strong. is strong.
Like, we started watching it because it was rated that high and we were like, fuck, it's got to be good. And we watched it and it was completely acceptable. Like, it was a fun, easy watch that isn't too taxing. It's not too challenging. Basically a long rom-com and is like at best a 7 out of 10. But it's fun. Like, 8.1 is a big stretch. But yeah, like, I was sitting watching it being like, this character that Adam Brody plays genuinely feels like Seth Cohen's grown up and realized like he's actually just a real hot boy.
Yeah.
And is subsequently
He knows he's hot.
He knows he's hot now. It's something that I didn't know I needed to come back into my life, but I'm really happy that it did. And I'm also really happy that Gen Z have really adopted him as well, because it doesn't feel like there's a huge amount of what millennials love that relate or has like transcribed to Gen Z or like transcended to Gen Z. It feels like there's quite a bit of disconnect between what we grew up on and what we love and what they're growing up on and what they love. Adam Brody and his just general hotness has bridged that gap seamlessly, because I'm seeing a lot of stuff on social media about like Adam Brody, just like Adam Brody's riz is a thing that I'm seeing a lot, which I hate in isolation. I hate the phrase in isolation, but I appreciate the fact that he is now being appreciated by he's a multi-generational hot boy, so I appreciate that. And
because also he's older than us. He's like 40.
That's actually the
thing on that show they never address. Like, on that show, I was like, are we meant to be imagining these people are like 33? Because I know they're both like 40 years old.
But this is the point. Because when you think about what they were like when they were in the OC or all of those naughty teen shows, they were like 22-year-olds playing 15-year-olds. Like, this is a natural progression for us to basically, like, we stopped watching the OC in 2004 or 2008 when it finished. Started in 2004. And then we've just picked up in 2024 when he's now in his 40s, but actually, like, nobody really says, but they're probably early 30s. Or I think, I'm not sure how old the characters are meant to be. But yeah, if they it felt when you watch the OC as a 15-year-old, you're like, these guys are meant to be the same age as me, or like roughly. Like, we'd be in the same school together. Like, we're not so far apart. And this feels the same as that. And like, that in itself is kind of ridiculous. Like, the early noughties teen shows of one casting like 20-year-olds to play 15-year-olds and just passing it off as this is how 15-year-olds look. Like, I did not look anything like that when I was 15. It took me to like my late 20s to look anything above 23.
To be fair, I think Misha Barton was actually like pretty close
but
to the age.
But she was like super young. She was like, saying she was like 17 when she was cast. All the others were in their 20s.
Kenzie was like 26 or something.
I've got different points on Misha Barton and Benjamin McKenzie, the commandee. But basically,
I found
it so funny that, one, the age of people that were cast, and they just played them off as actual genuine children. And two, the fact that this catalogue of naughty shows, so, you know, like The OC, One Tree Hill, all those type of shows, they cast these kind of alternative blokes who they tried to make out like, oh, you know, Seth Cohen, he's like a loser, nobody likes him, like people bully him, he's got no friends, and he, you know, like, of course he is, like, look at him, he's a loser, but actually, you know, he's actually one season in, you're like, oh, by the way, he's hot, and you're like, well, yeah, we can see that. Same with like Chad with Chad Michael Murray in One Tree Hill. He was like, oh, this kid with a handful of friends is a bit invisible at high school, loves to read books, people think he's a bit odd and standoffish. Let me tell you, if you drop Chad Michael Murray in any high school, where he looked like in season one of One Tree Hill, he would just be popular by the fact that he looks the way he looks.
Yeah.
Like, why did the naughty try and pass off these, like, objectively, like, clearly hot 20-year-old men as like 15-year-old losers. It was so strange, but like,
it's just, that's an American fantasy.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. I live for that. Also, like, in terms of casting in the OC, to move back to Misha Barton and Benjamin McKenzie, they are the two leads in that show. And compared to the rest of that cast, 6 out of 10. Like, that for lead characters, they are not pulling their weight. Like,
I would say season four, Ben McKenzie is pretty.
Oh, Ben McKenzie, the cage fighter.
Oh my god!
Off the avenge Marissa's death for Voltron.
He's just insanely beefy at that point. I was big on the summer train, the Anna train, the Julie Cooper train.
Young Olivia Wilde is in.
Young
that.
Olivia Wilde also good.
Adam Brody.
Trey.
Which one's Trey not Chris Pratt?
Trey is fucking Ryan's brother, right? He's Logan Marshall Green, the guy who looks kind of like American Tom Hardy.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well,
Chris Pratt comes in when Summer's gone to Brian.
Season four, his name was
Trey. Yeah, but he also was fat, Chris Pratt.
I don't know.
Yeah. Also, sure. Republican. But yeah, it was like...
Christian.
Yeah, like the casting of Misha Barton and Ben McKenzie is just questionable in terms of hotness, based on how hot the people around them are. But yeah, Adam Brody, very happy he's back in my life.
Yeah, when he on that show, I turned to Emma when we were watching the first episode and I said, I think he was actually like the crush of our generation. Everyone I knew was into him. And we kind of agreed that. And then we were trying to think of the female equivalent and we couldn't really. And then like 2 days later, I saw a Vogue article that was like, he was the crush of the generation. And I was like, I guess anyone can write for Vogue now.
Female equivalent?
I don't know. I was like, is it like fucking Jennifer Aniston or some bullshit like that? But she was a bit older. She was too old.
That's like 90s.
Yeah, she's too old. So I was just like, is there just a woman who we all agreed was like the hottest woman? And Emma was like, for a while, I think it was maybe Jessica Alba, which I thought was quite a good shout. I was never that big a fan, but I do understand it. Like
Jessica Simpson was about then at that time as well.
No, I just don't think there's one in the way that there was, like with the way that Adam Brody, I feel like if you'd gone into like...
But also it wasn't Adam Brody,
any classroom, if you'd gone into any classroom and been like, what do you think of a... you know, Seth Cohen from the OC, like literally every person would have been like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's just like, he's so hot. Anyway, yeah, agreed. I'm fine with this. I think there's always room for a returning hot boy.
Yeah. And it's good to know that he's still hot. He's held that mantle for over two decades and we've not even known it.
Yeah. He's just been like quietly married to Blair Waldorf.
Yeah. I find that
just
so
having
funny
a
as well.
Little hot marriage on the side.
Yeah.
Okay. What am I taking out of the burn book? Oh yeah. I'm taking Chapel Rowan out of the burn book.
Okay.
So...
H-O-T-T-O-T-O?
Oh, yeah. I thought I could get through the Chapel Rowan thing.
Sure.
Right? Because, like, I was like, Olivia Rodrigo. I managed to get through Olivia Rodrigo hype without learning a fucking thing about her, basically. I heard her songs on Instagram, but I couldn't tell you one of them. I literally could not name you a fucking Olivia Rodrigo song. No, yeah, I could. There's one called Driver's License.
I didn't even know.
Couldn't tell you what it sounds like.
Sure.
But I was like, I'll be damned if I learn anything about Chapel Rowan. And then I was just kind of like, I did hear some stuff about her and I was just like, okay, she's not a fucking Disney Channel kid, which I like. She's also not 20 years old. She's like 26. So I was like, okay, I find it hard to believe a 20-year-old has anything profound to say to me in a song, but I can believe a 26-year-old does. And also, you know, she's queer. She's like from like some bumfuck place in the Midwest, no offense. She's like from like a super conservative, Christian, boring asshole town, no offense. Like she just...
And I was love like, that you're saying offensive things and then following it up with no offense.
That's how it works, right?
Yeah.
So I was kind of curious about that. And I was just like, you know what? You know, I also found out that she was like, she was working in a drive-in in like 2021. She was like, this isn't going to work for me. I'm going to go home and like work at the drive-in. And I was like, fuck, man. Like, no silver spoon. You definitely have got to admit that like, this was not handed to her because she like comes from a family that works in the industry. And I was just like, right, fine. I will listen to her music. I listened to her music and I was like, is pretty fucking good. Like it's really good. Like it's not like it didn't change my life, but I listened to her album and I was like, there are like a couple of songs on this I don't like, but I basically like the entire album. I like Good Luck Babe. I think it's a good song as well. I was just like, she's actually singing about real experiences. She's talking about real things that clearly mean a lot to her, as opposed to like bullshit songs that are about fucking nothing, which is what I think a lot of the time. Like, a lot of the time I hear a song and I think this is about absolutely nothing. Like, absolutely nothing.
Yeah, like most of the Sabrina Carpenter stuff.
Yeah, Sabrina Carpenter songs are just, like, completely, like, generic, kind of like, oh my god, I like a boy, but do I trust him? Like, kind of like that kind of fucking horseshit. Yeah. Whereas, like, with Chapel Roan, you can see why, like, in a post-Taylor Swift world, people are like, we want songs to be confessional and to make us feel close to you. But I just liked it. I was like, this is good. This is good. I'm sure that a load of people, like, fucking hate it or whatever, but it's actually pretty good. It's certainly better than a lot of the shit that we had, equivalent shit when we were kids. And also, I kind of feel sorry for her because, like, she got famous insanely quickly and clearly has not had time to adjust to it. Like, a year ago, obviously there were people who knew who Chapel Roan was, but I had no fucking clue who she was. And now everyone knows who she fucking... Exactly. And now everyone knows who she is. And I think that is probably quite psychologically difficult to handle. And then, you know, she says stuff like, can everyone just fucking leave me alone and, like, not, like, run down the street after me and shout at me? And everyone's like, oh my god, you should be grateful for your fans. And I think, no, you should leave people alone. Like, they don't belong to you because they're famous. I can understand that you're like, well, you're famous because of me, you're rich because of me, blah 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 blah. But
privacy still exists.
I just think she's getting a raw deal, and I think she's interesting.
Is she like, getting criticized significantly for that?
Yeah, she got backlash because of that, because people were just like, oh no, like, we're entitled to every fucking thing about you because you made some songs and we bought them. And obviously people didn't buy them, they streamed them. So I don't know, like, I just think that she's interesting. I think that the fact that there are artists like her and, you know, like Billie Eilish, like, people like that are much more interesting than pop musicians were in our generation. Even the pop musicians who went on to be interesting from our generation, like, you know, Beyonce, for example, got more interesting over time. She was not that interesting at that point. She was just making, like, bullshit, like, pop R&B. She wasn't making songs. Yeah, but she objectively got more political and, like, you know, was making larger points in her work and got more ambitious, like, artistically. But that is a last 15 years thing, as opposed to when I was a teenager thing, when I was just like, Beyonce's really hot. That's her thing. So I don't know. I think it's a good thing that people like Chapel Roan exist. And, like, I'm not saying it's not, like, one of my favorite albums of all time, but I listened to it and I was like, this is great. And I think she's really good. And I like that this person exists. It makes me hopeful for my kids that they'll be able to listen to people like her and Billie Eilish. Rather than just having to listen to, I don't know, fucking the garbage that we were raised on. So that's what I'm taking out of the burn book.
Fair enough.
That brings us to the end of our public show for this week. Thank you very much for the questions you submitted. We're going to be dealing with a bunch more of them over on the paid side, as well as running through some of your hot takes. Continue to get your questions in. We always need them. And the ones that we've got already go in a big database. I haven't been able to reply to every single person. Normally I try and reply to people when they send questions, but we got so many this time that it was just literally not practicable. So I have not been able to do that, but we really do appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who leaves us 5-star reviews, who pays us money to make this show. If you don't pay us money, consider paying us money. That'd be really nice. And we'll catch you all next time. Bye-bye.